Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
Welcome, everybody. We are back and we have Mary Beth O'Connor back for the second time because I honestly just loved talking to her. Just wicked smart and thoughtful and a huge learner and an advocate in the space that I believe is actually one of the pivotal spaces that will change so many lives and the trajectory of humanity in so many ways. So welcome, Mary Beth.
Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. So for those of you, this is our second podcast with Mary Beth. Our first one was dropped on May 9th, and it is a great listen to. I listened to it again. I am a huge fan. I would encourage our listeners to go back if you haven't listened to it. It is well worth the listen. So that's the tee up for our time together today. And there was a couple things that we talked about on the front end just before we got on that I think that would be really important for our listeners to hear perspectives on. And one that was important for you was just touching again on the notion of as a loved one, and we're in this with people who are dealing with substance abuse disorder, and there's a relapse or a recurrence. And we kind of tend to think, oh, they're back to ground zero. If you would speak to that, I would really appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody really goes back to day zero. That sounds as if you learned nothing, as if you've forgotten everything that you learned, as if somehow your brain's been wiped clean of the knowledge, right? I mean, the person had some success for whatever period of time, and often it's weeks or even months. And so it's not like that time is forgotten. So there were things that were learned, things that were experienced, behaviors, habits, patterns that have been repeated during that time of sobriety that are there to be picked up again and to move forward. And the other thing is that I think a lot of it with a slip, what I encourage people to do is to really look at the details, like what exactly happened, so that you can have a plan for next time. For example, were you sort of surprised that somebody offered you a drink and you hadn't mentally prepared for it? It wasn't an environment where you were expecting it. Were you surprised by the amount of pressure that you felt, peer pressure maybe, or just didn't want to explain yourself or whatever it might have been? Mm-hmm. Was it something that you were sort of in the back of your mind thinking, well, maybe this one time's okay, or whatever happened, so that you can look at it and say, well, when that comes up again, what's my plan for next time? So that you build a stronger foundation, you've got it under control, you've thought it out in advance. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you ever do go back to zero. I mean, tracking time is a little different. Some people, when I say you don't go back to zero, they get mad. Well, that's not, you can't say you had 6 months if three times you used in 6 months. And it's like, well, to me, first of all, are you tracking sobriety time or recovery time? Because you can think of those as separate things. Continuous sobriety time is one way of tracking, right? I mean, people from the last time I used to till now, that's continuous sobriety time. But you can be in recovery for a lot longer than your continuous sobriety time. And I know people that have actually been sober like 5 years, except for 3 days in the 5 years. Well, then they count it as 5 years minus 3 days. And so whatever works. Right. The other thing I'll say is that tracking time can be helpful to a lot of people because they see it's a success point. Oh, I've got 30 days, 60, 90. But when people are struggling with getting any kind of length of continuous sobriety in the beginning, sometimes it's actually a negative and it can make people feel like I failed again, I failed again, I failed again. And sometimes it's better to just stop tracking. So it's sort of like any other tool. It helps some people or helps some people at some point, and sometimes it's not useful. So I think we need to get rid of this sort of rigid grasping on to last day I used, the next day is day one, and I have to track it, and I can only think of it as continuous sobriety and not the bigger picture. I think looking at the bigger picture can be often helpful, and it can help people see the bigger long-term pattern.
Yeah, I would say several things are coming out of what you just said for me. One is that it is figuring out what works versus what doesn't work. And I love the fact that you built a personal plan for yourself and you picked the tools and the beliefs and the things that you believe would work for you, and you let the rest go. And we tend to have these rigid ways of looking at how this has to go in order for it to work. And for the most part, that's just not the truth. So just the notion of thinking through, okay, does keeping track of time actually work for me in terms of supporting me in my sobriety and in my recovery? And if it doesn't, then dump it. So giving people permission to pick the things up that work and lay the things down that don't work.
There is actually not any tool that I can think of that works for everybody all the time. I mean, I just don't know of a tool like that. People are, they're different. And even what works at one point in your recovery may not be helpful later. I mean, I think about, for me, the identifier and in meetings, you know, I'm Mary Beth and I'm an addict. When I first got sober, I didn't mind saying it. I thought I sort of needed to beat it into my brain. You know, it was part of that process of acceptance that I really wasn't going to be able to use again, that I really did have a substance use disorder. But later, after about maybe 6 months, I felt it wasn't feeling connected to me, to who I was. I was announcing it like, this is the most important part of me. This is the essence of who I am.
Right.
And by 6 months sober, that felt untrue, that it wasn't really the essence anymore, that I was actually a person with some sobriety, that I wasn't an inactive addiction anymore. And so why was I announcing it as if I was? And then I found Women for Sobriety, where you announce, I'm Mary Beth and I'm a competent woman. Well, that's the introduction. And that met me where I was. And so the tool that helped in the beginning, it wasn't a tool that worked for me all the way through. And so I think we just always need to be paying attention to, is this working or is this not? And when someone has a slip or a relapse, it's a really good time for reevaluation. What have I been doing? Is what I've been doing helping me? Do I need to let anything go? But more also often, what do I need to add? Because if you do have some kind of a slip, usually it's a good idea to think about, what can I do to reinforce my program? What can I do to make it stronger? What can I do to reduce my risk of having this happen again?
Yeah. And just the notion of labels, that's another conversation. And I've had a lot of conversations with people in recovery and having a difficult time with what you just spoke to, is we're all bigger than our biggest, quote, mistakes or whatever it is. And so we're bigger than our addictions. And so if we just label ourselves, then we put ourselves in a certain box that doesn't allow for the fullness of who we really are in the world. And so,
yeah, except that I would say that for some people, it feels, it's a way for them to keep connected to something that they don't want to turn back to, right? So for some people, saying, I'm Mary Beth, I'm an addict for 10 or 20 years is comfortable. It's sort of, it's a reminder every day of the reality that they have a substance use disorder that most likely they shouldn't risk using any substances. So it just depends on the person. And I thought about it with the junkie title to my book, right? From junkie to judge, I thought a lot about word use and terminology, and I wouldn't use that for anyone else, but I used it on purpose because I wanted to own my IV drug use. And I wanted to use that title as sort of a destigmatizing tool that you can use from shooting drugs to a judge. And so it was for a certain purpose. I wouldn't use it in any other context, but in that context, it had a purpose. So I think it's important to think it through about what you're using and what's comfortable and what's helping you. I mean, to say I'm Mary Beth and I'm a competent woman, and that felt like, let's stand up straight. You sit up straight, be tall and be proud. That was energizing for me. But it really depends on who you are and where you're at. But it's important to be open to change and to be open to sort of constantly reevaluating the tools you're using and if they're still working for you.
Yes, absolutely. So amen, sister. And what you spoke to there, which we touched on when we talked previously, was this notion of humanity. And you became a meth user in a time when, man, you were like, at least the way that I remember those times, because I'm a little bit older than you, kind of the scum of the earth. And meth is so much more a thing now than it was back then when you were using it, from my perspective. And so for you to really poke at this whole notion of, no, I'm still a human being first.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the difference today is what I see on television. Part of what I really noticed, I watched some of those shows about people with a meth use disorder in sort of more rural, impoverished parts of the country. And it's presented as sort of entertainment, but as if they're not really real people, they're not presented as full human beings. There's really usually little context to their story. It's just sort of like watching a car crash, you know, look at how bad this is, almost like it's inexplicable. We can't understand it. We can't explain it. We can't therefore empathize or sympathize or be compassionate. Mm-hmm. And so I really don't like the way that meth users or any really drug users are presented in most of the media for that reason. Because they are full people with a full story. Something drove them to get to where they are today. Usually it's some kind of pain or trauma, but whatever the reason, it's not like they're living a happy life. It's not like they're thrilled to be where they are. We ought to be compassionate and not just sort of be looking at them as if they're almost animals in a zoo or something that's not really fully human. And that's the way it's often presented.
Yeah. And I mean, given the fact that one in three American families deals with a family member that is dealing with substance abuse disorder, what the heck are we thinking? I mean, you look on the right or the left of yourself, one of you is going to be dealing with it.
I know. You think that would reduce the stigma, but we're really not there yet, right? Mm-mm. We're really not there yet. And I think it is getting better, somewhat better, in part because more people are being open about their recovery. Mm-hmm. It's one reason I speak openly about my recovery and about the depths and horrors of my addiction. But you're right, because what other mental health issue do we have this kind of reaction to? I mean, don't get me wrong, it can be hard for people to acknowledge, say, professionally that they have a history of anxiety or depression or other things. There is some stigma associated, but substance use disorder is by far the most stigmatized of any medical condition that I know of, except maybe obesity, which it has a lot of stigma around it too. Mm-hmm. And it is crazy because we do all have loved ones who have struggled. I mean, and if you don't, you will soon, because it's just too prevalent for that. And it's almost like sometimes we understand the specifics of our person, but yet we're able to judge all the other people, which is crazy. It's like, well, they're other, but this is my person. My person, it's not her fault. My person, I understand. But those other people, they're in a different box. When they're not in a different box, they're the same. There's a common thread through all of this and for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And so super curious about kind of the other side of the coin. You dealt with your own addiction for 20 years and then you took it on and have been clean and sober for 30 years now?
29.
Okay. All right. Rocking on. Yeah, that's so awesome. And so then as a sober, clean person, you were dealing with your sister.
Right.
And your best friend still.
Yes.
And so I really want you to speak to the other side of the coin.
Yeah. I mean, when I talk to friends and family, I always emphasize, as you know, I'm friends and family to everybody with a substance use disorder. We are also friends and family. And so when I got sober, my sister, who's 2 years younger than I am, she was still using, and her circumstances were worse than mine. I was in a more stable housing situation and a more stable partner situation. She was homeless at times. Mm-hmm. And really living in much more challenging circumstances. And yet she wasn't getting sober on my timeline. So I brought my sister when I had about a year sober. She lived in Arizona. I live in California. And I convinced her, and it took some convincing, to go into my rehab. And then I would pay for her to go into my rehab. And she agreed. And I even got them to move her up the wait list faster than normal.
Yeah.
And I flew her from Arizona to California. And I drove her to the rehab. And 8 days later, they called and told me, well, she's insisting on leaving. And I was so frustrated. And I went there and I was like, and I sent her back on the bus. Like, I wasn't going to fly. I couldn't trap her in California. I couldn't trap her here, but I sent her back on the Greyhound. And she eventually got on her own path, but it was years later. And it was frustrating and it's frightening, right? Because sometimes she would disappear for months. One time we didn't hear from her for a year. I don't know if she's still alive, what's happening. I used to imagine what I would be doing when the phone rang and I got the call that she was gone. It's like that out in my head. So I understand the frustration. She didn't do it on my timeline, and it creates a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety and a lot of, but it's also about where's the line. So like with my friend Gina, my best friend in college and really the closest person I've really ever had, I felt so interconnected with her. Our histories were so similar. The love was so deep.
Yeah.
And when I got sober, she was really happy for me, but it didn't trigger her to do it. She had a heroin addiction, and I would see her and she was always excited. I was in the law school one day between classes. I ran into her in San Francisco and she was like telling her friends, oh yeah, she's going to law school now. But she didn't do it. And eventually she died. And there's all that second guessing. Did I make enough effort? Did I try to convince her? But there's no way to drag her in. I was an example. I would mention it to her, but there's that second guessing. Did I try?
Yeah.
Was I enough for her or was I not? And that was hard. That was really hard.
Well, you're touching on all the things that I've been through, that those of us who love people have been through. And like a year without hearing from your sister, how did you actually like navigate for yourself and stay mentally healthy and strong and living your life in the midst of what I call it? It's like, how do you thrive in the midst of the chaos and the trauma of this disease?
Yeah. I mean, when she was missing, my mother was actually looking through the papers for unidentified Jane Doe's because she had some tattoos and we could identify her that way. But I knew she'd been arrested. And so they could find her fingerprints. And I thought, well, eventually they would probably find us if she were gone, right? Because she had a criminal record. And it's one of those things where it comes and goes. Sometimes it's sort of in the background and then suddenly something triggers your memory and the fear rises up again. Or I don't know, it's my birthday and I didn't hear from her. Well, you know, usually I would hear from her at least on my birthday. And so, wow, what does it mean that I didn't hear from her? I mean, I was worried she had died, but I always also knew that even if she was alive, if she wasn't in touch with us, she was in a really bad place.
Right.
Because she would have been in touch with us if she was even doing halfway decent. And so I was just worried for what she might be going through, for what kind of living situation she was in, for what she was having to do to get drugs, or who she might be with, what man she might be with, how safe he might be or not. And we grew up in a violent household. We both had a tendency to pick violent boyfriends at times. And it's like you're trying to go forward with your life. And mostly I could, but every once in a while, there's that bam reminder that just brings up the fear.
Yeah. Well, I know that part of my experience, it has been, there's at times been kind of this just underlying unease, and I'm aware of it. I can feel it. And sometimes I'm better at relieving it than others. And so because of the worry, because of all the things that you just mentioned. So I think for certainly a lot of people, this is one of the big questions is, how do you manage in the middle of no connection for months or a year or years when you still have a heart that is wondering and still loving them from extension?
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of it is if it's having like a really significant impact on your own mental health or your own well-being, that's a time where you might need professional help to deal with your own feelings because they're valid, but there's a normal range where we're all going to have it in that situation. But for some people, it becomes more of a sort of obsessive cycle, or you just can't let go of the fear, really becomes embedded in your existence. And if you're in that place, then professional help is probably a good idea. And then there's also the friends and family support groups. And I know people know usually about Al-Anon, which is the 12-step version, but there are others. There's Hazelden, LifeRing offers friends and family, which is secular, Smart Recovery. So there's other friends and family options on the internet. There are groups, and that can be helpful to talk it out, just share your concerns and sort of like anything else. The shared understanding can be a stress reliever, an anxiety reliever, to know other people are going through it.
Yeah.
But it's a challenge. It is a real challenge.
Yeah. Well, and I think culturally we have more of a propensity to isolate up because we're ashamed. We're afraid of what people are going to think. And we think we're the only ones, and which is so ridiculous at this point. I mean, back in the day when this was prior to your experience in getting clean and sober, I helped my brother get into rehab. I didn't know anybody who was dealing with this. And I was open about it. And I felt very alone at that time. Now is hardly anybody that you can talk to that doesn't have it in their family or a friend. which is just, wow, it's stunning, actually.
Well, part of that hopefully is that people are being more open about it, because it was just as, I mean, the substance use disorder rate percentage in America hasn't changed that much over the last 20 years. I mean, it's high compared to the rest of the world. I mean, America has a bigger problem than the rest of the world.
Right.
But it hasn't really gone up much in the last 20 years. It's just that more people are talking about it, which is a positive. Mm-hmm. And so that can be good for people to know they're not alone and that there's others have gone through it. And also things like the practicalities. How do you find rehab for someone? What are the questions that you would ask, or how do you even evaluate these programs? Talking to other people who have been through it can not just be an emotional benefit, but there can be practical information that can be shared that can relieve the burden of trying to figure it out all on your own, all by isolation. So there's a lot of mutual support benefits at multiple levels.
Absolutely. And two things. One is we are more isolated now than we've ever been in terms of not having that two or three really close friends we can turn to. And when Sam was arrested and I was there, that was hugely traumatic for me. Well, as soon as I fell out emotionally, and when I picked myself back up again, I got on the bat phone and started calling my friends. And I've got a great community, and my community has grown so much larger now because of this experience and my realizing how important the community was for me to continue to navigate and stay mentally healthy and all the things. And so I think it's a courageous step for people to take that first phone call and ask for help or ask for guidance or ask for information.
Yeah. And the support groups can be a place to develop those friendships that you might be missing too, right? And so, it's for people with a substance use disorder too. A lot of early recovery friendships arise out of peer support groups. And that can be really helpful as you're moving forward and going along. And in fact, I mean, I know a lot of people hang out of those groups longer than they might need individually to be a sort of service to the newcomers that are coming in. And that can be a real sort of positive cycle of people sharing the information they have, sharing the support that they have, sharing the comfort that they have.
Yeah. So let's shift just a little bit here. It's connected to my head. Early in our conversation on the 9th of May, you talked about when you had that first drink of Boone's Farm, which is what my first drink was too, and how you felt happy. And so I'm super curious as to what's the happy for you now?
When I used to think about happy, I thought of it as sort of like the big joy event. Like it's got to be something big. Like you're going to the theater, or you're having your husband proposes, or the joy is somehow at this heightened level. Mm-hmm. And as I've gone through my sobriety time, I realized, no, actually happiness is really more sort of, I don't want to say mundane because that makes it sound like it's not a happy place, but at a more typical day level. So for me, happiness is really about, first of all, a lack of chaos.
Well said.
not being sort of emotionally distraught, but also it's the quiet times with my husband, or going out to dinner with friends and having a conversation, or feeling productive, feeling useful is a type of happiness, feeling that you're being of value, being there for your friends when they need you. I mean, I couldn't do that in my using, right? I mean, God forbid somebody could need me. They'd have maybe a 10% chance that I could focus on what they were talking about than be useful in any way.
Right.
So that sort of those connections and those relationships that are built through everyday conversations, but also when you need emotional support, they're there for you. When they need it, you're there for them. Those are really joyful experiences and happy experiences. Yeah, I like to go on vacation. Those can be happy times. But part of the reason they're happy is because I have time with my husband, or I'm visiting friends in out of town, wherever we are. I guess I learned to think of it more as contentment, more as emotional fulfillment from relationships, and more as the bonding time with my people. Those are sort of the primary sources of happiness.
Yeah. And so speak to the journey out of or into the depth of feelings.
I mean, when I was using, and really throughout my childhood, because of the violence, right? The feelings that I knew were really like heightened feelings, like rage and anger and frustration and fear and terror. Those were feelings that anxiety. I mean, that was a huge one.
Yeah.
But when I got sober and I went into therapy and my therapist would ask me, how did I feel about something? And I would really honestly, I would look perplexed. Like I had no words. And so she had to give me a feelings card. It had like 24 feelings. It was two columns. It was laminated. It was like this big. And when she asked me how I felt, or when Doc and I were having a conversation, she said, I should pull it out if I wanted to describe it. I had to look. And 24 is actually, there's a lot more emotions than that, but a couple of categories. Because I really didn't have the words or the connection, but also it did take a while for the less intense, less heightened feelings for me to even be able to know that I felt them, because I was used to operating at that level.
Yeah.
And so it took a while for me to be aware of moments of sort of small moments of happiness or feeling like productive because I got something done, or that bonded feeling when you're with a friend and you're having a close emotional conversation. It took me a while to even be able to feel those experiences, to really have those emotions come to my consciousness, make me aware of them. But so it was a really sort of a training process. But it was also that as I was having fewer of those crazy heightened emotions, there was almost space now for me to be able to have the more sort of everyday feelings, minor irritation even. I mean, minor irritation would have gone underneath my radar, but it took a while for me to know sometimes I would get snippy. Because it was an irritation like at this level, not this level, but
right
level. And I was reacting to it and I didn't even know I was reacting to it because I didn't know I was feeling it. And so part of it was also noticing those behavioral cues, like, why am I acting this way? Because it's sometimes I had to think, I had to sort of process it backwards. Here's the input. Here was my reaction. I wonder what the feeling was in between, you know?
Right.
Figure all that out. It was definitely an evolutionary process. And I think it's common with people in early substance use recovery, they usually either they are disconnected from feelings or they get overwhelmed by feelings they haven't had in a long time. Or sometimes it's a combination of both, depending on the specific emotional area and their past history. And so it is common that you might say get frustrated with something and it's like this overwhelming level that you don't know how to manage because you haven't had to experience managing it because you were using tamps down a lot of the emotions and you don't really get to feel them.
Yeah.
So it is a process for most of us.
Yes. Well, and I was talking to a dad who has a son dealing with substance abuse disorder, and he very successful CEO who was a workaholic. And so what he talked about was in terms of his own journey with this was learning how to feel also.
Right. Because if you're working all the time, you don't have time to do anything else, right? It's sucking up all your emotional energy, all your mental energy, and all your actual time. And, so, you know, it's why I'm on the board for She Recovers, and it's about recovery from anything. And overwork is a big one. I was just at an event, and a woman was talking to me about her perfectionism, how she always has this real, everything has to be perfect. And first of all, I told her, first of all, perfectionism can be a trauma response. But also it is a way can tamper down. It's an anxiety response, right? It's a type of anxiety. And that can keep a lot of other emotions at bay because all you're feeling is this one feeling's overriding everything else. I'm anxious. I need to be perfect. I'm working 78 hours a week. I'm either working and focused or I'm exhausted and sleeping. That's my entire life. There's no room for anything.
Right. Exactly. Yes. And that was part of what happened with his family was he was completely emotionally disconnected.
Yes.
I mean, he talked about being the person with the grand gesture because he was making so much money. He could pay for the trips or the cars or the boats or whatever that was, but he couldn't emotionally connect with his family. And so he chose to leave professionally and start on this journey of rediscovering what it was to be a human.
And that's sort of when I got sober and I went to law school, right? It's 6.5 years sober at the law school. And then I went and worked at a big law firm, which I mean, I'm a blue collar working class family. Mm-hmm. And I went to Berkeley Law. I mean, it's a major accomplishment in my sobriety. And then I got a job at a big law firm, something, I mean, my bonus was my mother's annual salary. I mean, it was like that big of a differential, but I got into that treadmill of all those hours and I had to cancel events. We'd have tickets to the ballet or whatever. And I couldn't go most of the time because I something would come up at work. I remember being on the beach and they're calling me, I'm on vacation. And it's just, and I was at work pretty much 7 days a week. But at first it was like an achievement that I had gotten something sort of back that I would have had earlier in my life if I wouldn't have been using until I was 32.
Right.
So yeah. It was an enticing achievement. Look what I've accomplished. It was reinforcing. It was a type of happiness in the beginning, but over mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. it was just sort of getting, it was overtaking my life. And mm-hmm. so it was really about, well, is this how I want to live? Like, I actually do have a choice here.
Yes.
I don't have to keep going like this, even though there were reasons why it attracted me 4 years ago. It doesn't mean I'm committed for life, right? Like, yeah. Yeah. When I decided to leave, I said, they can't make me do it. Like, I don't have to do this anymore. But you can get in that cycle because yes. there is that positive achievement, especially if you're achievement oriented. But there's a positive benefit in the beginning, but it can lose its sheen and lose its benefit over time. And seeing that it has done that can be challenging when you're stuck in this sort of the high-paced cycle. It's hard to find time to even stand back and evaluate it when you're in that kind of a treadmill.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and it's a different type of addiction. I mean, it steals your life just as much as the other stuff does.
Yes.
And so we live in a culture that massively rewards that kind of behavior. And so I do think it is courageous and countercultural to be able to actually say, is this the life that I want to live? And then say, nope, this is not the life I want to live. And I'm going to go create the life I do want to live.
Yes. When I resigned that job, it was a huge, I mean, I debated that decision for a long time, but I never regretted it after I left. It's just, mm-hmm. it was a big step. Mm-hmm. But it was really about, yeah, now I'm sober now. Is this how I want to spend the rest of my life? It's not really what I want. I needed more balance and more time for friends and family is really what it mostly came down to. I needed more time for friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so did you go from the law firm to being a judge? What was the transition there?
I went from the big firm to a smaller firm for a year. And then I started working for the federal government as a lawyer first. As a lawyer. I mean, I was leading or co-leading class actions worth like $100 million. I mean, it wasn't like I was, even when I got to the government job, somehow I ended up on this somewhat of a treadmill. It was a slower paced treadmill, yeah. but it was somewhat of a treadmill. But the good thing was, I remember when they gave me one of my big cases, I realized at one point, I was like, well, I'll do this if you want me to. But I didn't really feel the need to do it anymore. The mm-hmm. need to have the biggest case or the most prestigious case or the, mm-hmm. it was like, well, if you want me to do it, you're paying me and I will do it and I will do my best. But mm-hmm. I had lost emotional requirements mm-hmm. to be the golden girl, which right. really I had been. But I did work for them as a lawyer for 8 years before I became a federal administrative law judge. So yeah.
Yeah. So the way that I interpreted part of what you said was just the need to prove yourself.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, there was just that sense of lost time, right? I mean, I got sober at 32. And so mm-hmm. I sort of felt like I was trying to make up for what I would have had if I mm-hmm. wouldn't have been in my addiction, especially for those last 10 years after college. If I would have been sober when I graduated college, my life would have been very different than getting sober at 32. Well, there was financial pressure. Also, I was behind, I had debt and I was behind on like retirement savings and all those other things, right? Had a bigger mortgage on my house than I probably would have had if I would have been working for 10 consecutive years instead of using meth for those 10 years. Right. So there was some real like actual financial needs that needed to be addressed and resolved.
Yeah.
But it was also that sense of trying to get back a loss. And like mm-hmm. when I got into Berkeley Law, which I had started to do right out of college, but couldn't because of my addiction, that was like a recouping something mm-hmm. that I wanted. But it is easy to get caught up in that and keep going and not really stand back and reevaluate. And it was Gina's mm-hmm. death that really caused me. I mean, I was thinking about it a little okay. bit, but her death was really a push again. It was like, I felt that even though I don't think I could have made her go into rehab, I was working so much, I really wasn't available to her. And I right. was really thinking about, do I want to do that again, to not be available to my people? And also, it was just wearing on me after 4 years. But I was used to, like in school, had always been my special place. I had always gotten a lot of positive attention. I did really well in law school. I got the top tier job. At the top tier job, I was excelling. I was at the top of my class
right.
Every year. And so that was sort of where I had always had my positive reinforcement. And I was really happy to get back that type of positive reinforcement again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then to be able to stand back and say, yeah, but that's good, but I can't live my life racing for it or trying for it. That can't be the goal of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so
it could be, but I don't want it to be. That's what it could be, but I don't really want that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I genuinely think, I mean, that story is very emblematic of what success story in America, and more people are reevaluating what really is success. And so this idea of the importance of relationships in our lives and that we want more of them and more time with our people. And we want to be more an expression of love instead of productivity.
Yeah. I think we all want to be productive to a point. Like I remember saying, look, if that law firm, it wasn't the work. If they would have let me work like 75% of the hours that I was working, I might have stayed because it was the volume. Right. So it is about the right balance. And I do think some of the younger generation are being a little more, their priorities have shifted to a certain degree. And I hear sometimes the people my age complaining about it, but really they're really setting boundaries, right? They're setting some boundaries around what they're willing to do to be successful. That they'll do this, but they're not going to go that far. And good for them. You know,
yes. I'm totally in support. I mean, I do really believe that it is causing, well, hopefully most of us to reevaluate what does success really mean in life?
Yes.
And being a productivity cog in the cosmic wheel is not life success.
Right. And most people that, I mean, I'm sure there's a small percentage of people that they really love it and good for them. But for most of us, it's a standard that's been imposed on us culturally that we may not really agree with. We just haven't always had time to stand back and think about it. And so it's nice to have people think about it. And I always say in recovery, it's not uncommon that people have this urge to make up for lost time, right?
I
mean, so you're getting in recovery, you know, especially if you didn't get so much, let's say your 30s or your 40s, you have this sense that you need to make up for things. And that can be an impetus that can sometimes derail us onto a track that it actually isn't what we want in the long run, because but you're trying to make up for lost ground, whether it's financially or professionally, or just to sort of rebuild your sense of your value in society. And that can sometimes turn amiss, especially over time.
Right. And so are you in the worlds that you walk in now, are you having some of these kinds of conversations with people?
I definitely see a lot of the younger lawyers that I talk to look at it differently. Like, for example, I mentor a student every year at Berkeley Law, first generation professional, because that's what I was.
Right.
While they want, some of them are interested in the same big law track, they're really concerned about the demand. Right. So they want to have a real conversation about what's the job really like? What am I really expected to do? What am I really giving up? And what am I going to get for it? And so one of the things I talk to them about if they do it is they should think of it as a sort of a 2 to 3 year commitment. And that while they're there, here's the skills you should get so that if you choose to leave, you can leave. Like you always be thinking about what's in my own best interest. How am I building my resume up so that I could walk out if I want to? And also financially, to be careful not to get what we call golden handcuffed, right? Not to get so much financial obligations that you need that salary in order to survive. So there's techniques that you can share with the younger people to help them avoid getting trapped. And that's the worst thing is when you find yourself sort of trapped. So a lot of people don't have that option, right? There are people who have to work 2 jobs for survival.
Right.
And that's a whole nother level of problem in our society, that structural problem that people have to do that. And for them, it's not as simple as saying, I choose not to work 60 hours a week, or I choose not to do this. It's not always an option for people, but for those who it is, it can be important to really think about what you want your life balance to look like.
Yeah. And so where are you currently in the life that you are inspired to create?
You know, when I took, and I emphasize early retirement, right? It was like early in 2020. And my goal at that point was really to do what I've done. I wanted to finish my book and I wanted to really develop an advocacy role, because I felt like not enough people talk about multiple pathways, or at least it's not at a high enough visibility, that there needs to be more people talking about it and trying to get opportunities at as high a level and as frequent a level as I can. And I felt that my individual story, because it was unusual, the junkie to judge, might capture attention and let me do that. And so and the other thing I really wanted to talk about was the substance use trauma connection, because I think people underappreciate it. And also that can be a stigma reducer. Appreciating that could be one avenue to help reduce stigma. If people knew the context, maybe they wouldn't be so judgmental about it. And so I wanted to build that role for myself, but also at a part-time level so that I could do some more things with my husband and do some more things with my family, but still want to be of service, still want to be of use. And this is a new role for a new phase of life. for me. And it's an exciting role, but it also is intellectually challenging. I mean, there's a lot of new research coming out about substance use disorder and recovery. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I really try hard to keep up on that, all the studies and the new ideas and the new thinking, because things have really changed in the 29 years that I've been sober. And to be as useful a tool as I can in sharing some of that information. I was speaking at a National Association of Mental Illness event recently, and they were asking me about decriminalization. I gave my what is usually my number one point, which is that the federal government defines SUD as a disease and yet it criminalizes it. And this is a contradiction. And a woman in the audience stood up and she goes, "You just blew my mind." I'm like, "Well, good. Like, this is what the impact that you want is to share ideas and help people understand at a deeper level." Right. And that was just very rewarding to hear her sort of in the moment emotional response, but to know that it's getting through and it's sharing information that can add value, help change minds, help promote the evidence-based approaches, help reduce stigma, help people be a little more empathetic, all of those things. And so it does feel rewarding to be at this point in my life where I've never been able to talk about my story openly professionally. I never did it. And so now that I can, I'm trying to use it as a tool, right? For me, it's a tool.
Yeah. Are you at that point, since you're in the space of service and advocacy, right, as a life's path, where you're able to identify your experience as a gift?
No, I really don't. I mean, I would never want anyone to have to go through what I did. And I know people go through it every day. I mean, my experience is, well, the combination of having the child physical and sexual, two multi-assailant rapes, other sexual assaults and violent women, that combination is a little on the high side. My ACE score is an 8, which is on the high side. Mm-hmm. But people go through those experiences every day. Right. And I don't think that's a benefit. I think once it happens, you have to decide what you're going to do with it and how you're going to use it. And in some ways, sometimes it was helpful. I mean, when I had that multi-assailant rape where I really could have died, my trauma history actually came in handy.
Yes.
Because I knew how to disassociate from the emotions and to deal with the situation. So that was helpful. Probably saved my life, but it would have been better to have had neither of those experiences.
Right. Right.
So I do think whatever happens, we have to figure out what are we going to do with it? How are we going to process it? How are we going to use it? How can it increase our empathy, our understanding? How can it help our growth? All of that. Can I use it as a tool? But I certainly would not wish it on anyone. I don't think that, I think it's, I don't know. The things like everything happens for a reason drives me crazy because I don't think that's true. And it's really minimizes the pain that people go through in their experience. It's as if saying, well, you know, it shouldn't hurt that much because it's for use it for a valuable purpose. Well, the pain is real. We have to get through the pain. We have to process the pain. If we can do something beneficial with it, that's wonderful. But
yeah,
I really would like us to do is to reduce the frequency of these events so that fewer people have to go through them.
Yes. So two things that pop up as you're saying this, Mary Beth. One is that my experience so far is that because of all the things you did experience, you are kind of uniquely qualified to speak to this in ways that I have not run across anybody who has the kind of experience you have. And so for us, I'm blessed and so grateful that you are who you are in terms of your experience and the impact that you will be able to have because of your experience. So I'm deeply grateful. And yes, I would never wish this on anybody. And then kind of the flip side of that is I just want to give kind of an exclamation point for the gratitude for you and how you're able to articulate this in ways that other people aren't able to hear. And I think there'll probably be more women that rise up in the audiences and go, "You just blew my mind." And hopefully some more men that rise up also. So, oh, I know. One of the things I was wondering was, what are you reading right now? What's something that you've learned that actually has begun to kind of shift your thinking about this whole world that we're living in?
Well, I mean, on the recovery side, my ideas have evolved. Like things like I was taught when I went into recovery that if you have a substance use disorder for one substance, you can 100% of the people who ever had a problem with any substance can use no substances again for the rest of their lives. That's what I was taught. Mm-hmm. And I assumed it to be true. Well, it turns out the science doesn't actually support that. There are people who can give up one substance and manage another. And there's actually some data that shows that if you had a substance use disorder for one substance, your odds of developing for another are lower than the general population. It's an interesting study. So I don't mean to say that everybody who had a problem should be going out and trying other drugs. I don't. I never will. I mean, my abstinence is solid. I do feel that for me, probably because of the severity of my substance use disorder. Another change is we don't talk about it as a light switch, but as a curve, right? Mild, moderate, severe, like other mental health illnesses. I think for me, picking up any substance would be extremely high risk. And I do think their odds are high. Eventually, I would turn back to a problem. So I don't do it. Mm-hmm. But I'm not everybody. And people that are on the more mild scale may find that they can give up alcohol because it's really bad, but cannabis isn't causing a problem. Mm-hmm. And part of it's the way we define a substance use disorder, right? It's about negative consequences.
Yes.
If you're using the cannabis without anything else, and it's not having the significant negative consequences in your life, it actually doesn't count as a substance use disorder. But it's also that now there are some medical benefits for some conditions for using low dose hallucinogenics or ketamine or cannabis for some conditions. Those are beneficial. And certainly I support medication-assisted treatment for buprenorphine and methadone and whatever it might be, naloxone, as a tool to help people to have a stable life. And it used to be, well, you're on methadone, you're not sober. Well, I don't care. To me, that's crazy talk. If you're on a maintenance drug that's allowing you to live your life without the negative consequences, you may be dependent, but that's not the same thing as addiction, right? Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the more nuanced ideas and different changes in my thinking that have happened. And I think it's important to talk about the true spectrum and not just to limit ourselves to black and white, the yes or no. We have to be more honest. But part of it is that you lose people if you tell them things that aren't the truth, right? I mean, we need to be honest about the reality. When people tell me, newbies tell me that they want to give up one thing and keep the other, my advice to them is, well, that works for some people, but it doesn't for a lot of people, it won't work. So what I suggest is that if you want to try it, that's fine, but be honest about what's happening as a result, right? Are you actually able to keep the other substance under managed use such that it's not having those negative impacts on your life? And if the answer is no, you got to admit that to yourself and to build a new plan. Maybe you're a person who perfect abstinence is going to work better, you know? But to pretend as if nobody can do it or it's never the right answer is false. And I don't want to be giving people false information, even when it requires a more complicated and lengthy discussion than just no.
Yes. And people have a tendency to want to make decisions black and white, and they're simpler that way. Well, life is complicated. We're complicated. And like you said, one thing for one person is not what the same thing is for another person. And so sussing that out is a journey.
Yeah. And the science evolves, right? I mean, there is a lot more research in the last 10 years than there was in the 10 years before that. And so, I mean, part of what I'm saying, there's data, there's actual data that shows this, right? So it's not like some crazy idea or just people's individual experiences. There's some data behind this. And we need to be open to the new ideas and to changing our mind and to following what is shown to work for some people and to really get out of this is what worked for me, therefore it's the right answer for everybody. I mean,
exactly.
Somebody says that, that's just to me a red flag. That's just
yes.
I am an abstinence person. I will be abstinent for the rest of my life. That doesn't mean I think everyone has to follow my exact path or that's the only path forward.
Yeah. And you spoke really so well about the picking the things that would work for you and letting the rest of it go. And the notion that you were told that it had to look a certain way. And I do think that's always a recipe for questioning when you were told it absolutely has to look this way. If you don't do it this way, you're doomed.
Part of it, it's like thinking about, like, say, parents when they talk about drugs with their kids. If you give them false information, then even the parts you said that were true get discounted, right? I mean, because if you have to be, if you're lying about part of it, then your entire message is undermined. And so yes. It's really more important to tell the truth that it is recovery is a process and it does require that honesty. Yes. I mean, if newcomers want to try, some people, for example, moderate down to abstinence. I was told when I started, you can't do that. It's you got to shut it all off. But the reality is the data shows some people actually can and moderate. Mm-hmm. They do better moderating down to abstinence. And so mm-hmm. when a newbie tells me they want to try that, mm-hmm. my information is actually for some people that works. But you need to keep your eye on your plan. If you say you're going to reduce it this much over this 2 weeks, did you do it? Or are you still mm-hmm. back where you were? And so it is almost a little more work than just trying mm-hmm. to shut it off because you've got mm-hmm. to look at the nuances. But it partially does require that the person who's in recovery is trying, who has a plan, is keeping their mind open and their eyes peeled for what's actually right. happening as a consequence of their plan. Is their right. plan working? Is a yeah. question you need to be asking a lot in the beginning.
Yeah. And I think the truthfulness about what's working, what's not working is probably paramount, mission critical. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's even the whole truthfulness with parents when they talk to their kids about drugs. I mean, look, the opioid overdose epidemic, well, the overdose epidemic in general, I think about 20% or more, maybe 25 are actually stimulant related deaths. But for parents to be honest about the reality of things, it's just say no. Well, the truth is, I mean, a very high percentage of parents today dabbled in drugs in their teenage years. They mm-hmm. just didn't develop a problem.
Right.
But today, dabbling can be even more dangerous than it was then because mm-hmm. of fentanyl and other issues. And so having right. an honest conversation about things like don't use behind closed doors by yourself, because that's how people die. Your friends should have Narcan and an understanding about how to use it if anybody's using drugs, if you're using mm-hmm. it in a group. Maybe you don't all do it together. Maybe one person tries it, see what happens, you know, then the next, and just that awareness that they don't know what they're taking. It's mm-hmm. not that you're saying, go ahead and do it. It's that you're giving them honest information because the mm-hmm. odds are either they or someone they know is going to do right. things. And right. to stick your head in the sand and just say no, like the Reagan motto, it just doesn't work, but it can cause unexpected consequences. People, your kids won't talk to you, or they know you're not telling the full picture, or you're not there for them to have an honest conversation about it.
Right.
And I know when I was a kid, the things we heard about like LSD, everybody went crazy and ended up in a mental institution. Well, as soon as you find out that's not true, then you don't believe anything they said. Right.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Well, and I very well remember the do not say no to drugs campaign. What a farce.
Yeah. And also they had a lot of, who was talking about that the cops were coming into the schools. So it wasn't mm-hmm. as if it was being talked about from a health perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is what we should be teaching kids is these are the real risks of drugs. Like there are real risks. Mm-hmm. And it's important that the teenagers informed about those actual risks so they understand them.
Right.
And maybe can take some steps to reduce them. I don't want to pretend all drug use is positive. It's not all positive. Mm-hmm. Even if people don't develop a substance use disorder, they can get pregnant. They can have car accidents. They can get in a fight and get arrested and have a criminal. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of consequences that can come from drug use that right. we should be honest about, but mm-hmm. it's got to be in the bigger context of being also realistic about what's going on.
Right, exactly. Well, it's almost like a split conversation in terms of health risks, and yet we criminalize it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a whole other big conversation, I think, for us culturally to have. That mixing is crazy making. It doesn't make any sense at all. And yet we're still so steeped in arrest them and put them in jail and don't give them access to the resources that they need in order to turn their lives around. And it's insane.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is it's defined as a disease by the government, and a high percentage of the people that are in jails or prisons for yes. possession, and that's just a pure possession. And I think mm-hmm. there's around 500,000 people still today in jail just for possession. A very high percentage of them do have an actual substance use disorder. But even if they don't, mm-hmm. why do I care if they're doing drugs if it's not harming anybody else in any mm-hmm. other way? And if it's harming other people, there's usually another crime related to it, mm-hmm. or theft or assault or driving under the influence. So there's laws to take care of those other areas. Mm-hmm. You don't really need laws to worry about people's personal use when most personal use is not problematic. Most yeah. personal use is at a moderate level. Mm-hmm. Most personal use doesn't require any other crimes or any harm to anybody else. And that's mm-hmm. the truth of it. But we behave the opposite of that. And mm-hmm. criminalizing has so many ripple effects of destroying people's lives that it's right. plus the racial disparity in enforcement, which I think we talked about last time, is a whole separate problem that undermines the way that we implement the drug laws or whether they should even be on the books at all for personal use.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so we're kind of at our time.
That was quick.
Yeah, I think we could probably talk for a couple more hours. So I do want to say immense gratitude to you. And is there anything that you want to leave our listeners with in terms of their journey as somebody who loves somebody dealing with this disease?
Well, I mean, I will say, you know, my book, From Junkie to Judge, One Woman's Triumph Over Trauma and Addiction, it does, 30% of the book is about recovery from the SUD and from the trauma. And I do think that can be a useful tool. And I do have guidelines and checklists in the back. But also to think about, well, I would mention CRAP. I guess I would say for friends and family, if I were in this situation today where I had a friend or family member, I would look at the community reinforcement and family training, which is a really good technique for family members. That's where I would focus if I were a friend or family member. But mostly get the support that you need. Think about, you're allowed to think about your own mental well-being. You're allowed to have, you can be loving and have boundaries, all of these really important ideas.
Great. Well, thank you again. I know you're super busy with the book and all the speaking engagements and interviews and so on and so forth. And for those of you who are not familiar with her book, it is an absolute read. I think it should be on the top list of books that are read for so many reasons. So it is a page turner and it is brilliantly done. And I think the messaging matters at this point in time. So thank you for writing that.
Thank you. I really wanted it to be useful. So I'm glad to hear that that's how it's hitting.
Yeah. Well, it's getting circulated in my circles. So, well, thank you for your time again and have an amazing summer. Enjoy while you're home. And I think we'll probably have another conversation maybe next year when you're a little bit more settled.
Perfect. Thank
you. Okay. Thank you. All right. Take care.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.